Ms. King, you'll be able to bring less paper next time, I think. All right, the next case we're going to hear today is Paul Morrell, Inc. versus Kellogg, Brown & Root Services. And when we get the transition here, we'll hear from you, Mr. Harris.
May it please the court. I'll first address the lack of reliance, and then I'll address the damages and punitive damages issues. KBR acknowledges the district court's fact findings. They're against KBR. But what this appeal is really about is undisputed facts that are outcome determinative. As a matter of law, the undisputed evidence negates justifiable reliance. That evidence is dispositive under settled Texas law, and this renders the other facts relied on by TES legally immaterial. There's also no damages as a matter of law. The pay when paid clause bars the recovery of damages, and that's likewise a legal issue.
So on the justifiable reliance issue, we would have to find the district court's findings were clearly erroneous.
Your Honor, under our argument, there is no justifiable reliance as a matter of law based on undisputed evidence. And that looks at the standard under Texas law and looks at the press release and the Wall Street Journal and other.
It is a factual finding.
There is not a factual finding on this issue. The factual finding that the district.
Under Texas law, is justifiable reliance a factual finding?
It can be a factual finding. In many cases, and in most of the cases cited in our brief, it's determined by the court as a matter of law. This is very often under Texas.
The facts are undisputed and no reason to fact finder finds to the contrary.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's our exact argument here. The Texas Supreme Court reaffirmed last year that to negate justifiable reliance, you don't have to have just actual knowledge of the truth. You can also negate it as a matter of law where the truth is obvious from the facts or there's red flags indicating that reliance is unwarranted.
It's a very tough general posture to make when you have the finding that your client deliberately misrepresented facts and then argue that the other side shouldn't have trusted what you deliberately set out to misrepresent. And the district court did find as a fact, whether it's entitled to or not, but it did find as a fact. The court further finds that TES reasonably relied on KBR's misrepresentations and laid out its reasons why.
Yes, Your Honor.
Your argument has to be that facts don't support it or facts were misinterpreted. It may be a matter of law. There's no evidence.
Part of it deals with what the proper standard is. And Texas law is very clear on that. I mean, the Texas Supreme Court last year in Grant Thornton made the statement of law very clear. That's been long the law in Texas. The Fifth Circuit has applied that law for the last 20 years, and it's where the court also looks at facts making the truth obvious or red flags. The facts making the truth obvious goes back to the restatement.
But the judge didn't find that there is such facts.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The judge didn't find, make that finding for you.
Well, what the judge found was, and this is in paragraph 52 of the findings of fact, he said, some of TES's officers suspected that certain of the representations were untrue. And this is a direct quote, TES did not, in fact, know, close quote, at the time that the representations were untrue. That's not the test under Texas law. That's the test that TES argues. that actual knowledge is required. That isn't the test under Texas law. And here we do have undisputed evidence. There's the press release. It's undisputed that TES had the press release.
God, it also said TES did not have the means of determining the representations were untrue. And it took reasonable steps because of its suspicions to ensure that they were true.
And the reason,
those are all factual findings.
And the reasonable steps that they took were having it put in writing in Amendment 2. If that's a factual finding, it's clearly erroneous. I believe it's a legal point. Under the Madison 1 holding.
Let me ask you something. You know, a fact is a fact. Something happened in history. And a fact cannot be determined legally. The consequences of those facts can be. But there is no way that we can tell the district court that the fact didn't occur when the district court found the fact and there's evidence to support it. Now, if there's no evidence to support it, you've got a different proposition. But we have to start with a proposition that we're reconstructing history as a factual matter. And the district court did that. Now, the way we review those findings is in the federal courts for clear error. Now, the consequence of reliance, whether it is reliance, whether it is justifiable reliance, is a legal question, just like whether something's negligent is a legal question. But the facts leading up to whether we make a negligence conclusion are always facts. And so I think, unless you're going to challenge them, you're going to at least have to start with the facts found in relationship to reliance, and then handle those as a legal matter.
Well, Your Honor, and I will start with the press release. The press release was not impeached. TES had it. They were emailing it to each other, so there's no...
But the judge said that any misgivings that they had were dispelled by Amendment 2, in that paragraph 52, I think.
Yes,
I mean,
Your Honor.
You might have had... You argued that there were some things in the press release that should have put them on notice that y'all were lying to. And the judge said, well, they went out and asked him to put it in writing. They wrote up this Amendment 2, and they all signed off on it. And that dispelled, or that resolved our misgivings, or their misgivings. And that's what he writes up in his opinion.
And
is that clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm not sure I fully agree with that's what the district court did. But the press release
is... Whatever the district court did is written down there.
Yes, Your Honor.
But I'm referring to, particularly to your paragraph 52 that you referred to.
Yes, Your Honor. The press release is undisputed, and it's not that it just put TES on notice. It affirmatively said the accurate state of affairs. It said that there was an agreement reached between KBR and the government, and that KBR then had to negotiate with its subcontractors. So we have that piece of undisputed evidence issued by KBR's parents. That's what investors rely on. It was filed with the SEC. We have that official document. It's unequivocal. No one has impeached it. No one has challenged that.
But that doesn't address the problem. The problem is whether the government specifically directed that TES's claims be reduced. And there was a covenant put at the insistence of TES in the agreement and with the representation of Kellogg's counsel.
All of that.
That's a finding of fact.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is one of the findings. We set out in our brief, we group these into six findings is the way we have set it out. And I think all of these end up turning over whether there's a decision, but we have undisputed evidence and then the proper legal standard, and the district court didn't apply the proper legal standard. In paragraph 52, the district court looked at whether TES in fact knew that the representations were untrue, and that is not the standard under Texas law. The Texas Supreme Court last year...
There was quite a bit of evidence that the TES people doubted what KBR was saying. They doubted what was in the press release. But then they had, as Judge King indicated in his questions, they had these assurances that came through in a letter from Mr. Surjan and also in this Amendment Number 2. So I'm having trouble following the connecting of the dots that says that the press release in and of itself is a determinative piece of evidence.
It's determinative in that it raises a red flag, and that's the standard under Texas law. It's not that TES had to, in fact, know. That's what they argue on appeal. They, in their brief, they don't cite Grant Thornton. They don't acknowledge that that's Texas law. TES instead says you can only negate justifiable reliance when there is actual knowledge. That is not the test under Texas law.
Your view of Texas law that if there is suspicion by a party which is affirmatively dispelled by the other party, that that's a red flag that bars reliance?
It can be. And the Madison 1 Holdings case cited in our brief is a good example. There were oral misrepresentations made, and the parties put it in writing. There was an asset purchase agreement where those statements were put in writing. The district court, that was a federal district court opinion, the court there held that there was no justifiable reliance as a matter of law. The court said putting it in writing doesn't make reliance justifiable, and that is Texas law. Whether the representation is oral or written, you still have the same justifiable reliance test. And here, again, you have to look at whether TES knew facts making the truth obvious or whether there were red flags indicating that reliance wasn't justified. And you've got two different scenarios going on. You have a press release saying that there's been a settlement with the government and KBR is then going to have to go negotiate with its subcontractors. You have what's going on in the media. You've got the Wall Street Journal article, again, calling this a settlement after extensive negotiations. That was picked up in the business media. It ran everywhere from the London Financial Times to the Washington Post to the New York Times. This was a big deal that was noticed in the business press because it was a $1.2 billion settlement. The newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, said this is a settlement agreement. That is a red flag. That is undisputed. The press release said this is a settlement that's been reached with the government. It is a settlement agreement, and KBR then has to go negotiate with its subs.
I don't think any of that addresses the misrepresentations on which they relied. The misrepresentations on which they relied were much more specific.
Your Honor, some of them were, but I believe all of them end up tying back to ultimately whether there was a decision or an agreement. In our chart on pages 27 and 28 of our brief, we group these into six categories. And one in four of those clearly do that. Representation one is as to whether there was a decision. Representation four is as to the remedy. The remedy depends on whether it was a decision or agreement. If you then go back and look at the others, I think that they all end up tying to that because that is the allegation here, that KBR committed fraud and made misrepresentations as to who the remedy was against. And TES's ultimate position in this case is that if they had known that the remedy was really against KBR, they would have sued KBR to recover the additional $12 million. So all of this really hinges on whether there was a decision or whether it was an agreement. And that is what is addressed in the press release. That is what is addressed in the Wall Street Journal article. And if you apply the proper standard under Texas law,
articulate the proper standard.
The proper standard under Texas law is that there is no justifiable reliance whenever a party knows the truth, and they agree with that, and they say that's the only test, and also where the party knew facts making the truth obvious, or two, had red flags indicating that reliance is unwarranted. And that is...
The court found expressly against those in the statement, that part of the statement you quoted. It said it had no basis for concluding otherwise and no access to knowledge which would demonstrate otherwise. And it did seek its assurances to make its reliance from an attorney who has independent obligations to be truthful and not misrepresent.
And, Your Honor, to the extent the access to information is a factual finding, in light of the press release and the Wall Street Journal article, that is clearly erroneous. It's not just having access to find it. They had those documents in their file. They were emailing those documents to each other. It's not that they had to go out and investigate, and we're not alleging a duty to investigate.
Yeah, but I think the facts you're talking about are much grosser and more general than the facts on which they relied. They were impressed by the fact that the government focused on TES basically mandated that TES would have to remit $12 million. And this was a plan of attack to give them that impression. The talking points. You maybe want to, we understand that, but you may want to spend a little time on damages because it's a difficult issue.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I can make one comment on your last statement. Again, that goes to whether there was a decision or whether it was an agreement. Whether the government directed it specifically to TES, if there's a decision, that's one thing. If there's an agreement, that's another. I do believe all of this does ultimately hinge on whether there was a decision or whether there was an agreement. And that's what the press release and that's what the Wall Street Journal and the other news articles go to. KES had the truth in its hands. That is a minimum, a red flag. And now we'll turn to the damages issue. As a matter of law, the pay when paid clause bars recovery. The argument here is that there is a requirement to apply the prevention doctrine, and that's why the district court didn't apply the pay when paid clause as the prevention doctrine, that under Texas law, there's a requirement that the preventative conduct be wrongful. And the conduct here that's alleged to be
Why would you say that pay when paid clause applies? Because KBR got paid.
KBR did not get paid in full. There was a $55 million decrement, and there was no finding.
That was its deal with the government. That wasn't necessarily its deal with TES. I mean, it got paid in a lump sum under this agreement with the government, and that agreement did not have a corresponding agreement with TES until you got into this Amendment 2 and the release, which is the basis of the suit, that directly tied whatever the government was paying KBR to what KBR was going to be paying TES. Because on page 2608 of the, that's the wrong page. Anyway, whatever page the settlement agreement is on, 2544, the government, KBR, just agrees to a flat sum. So, why isn't that sufficient to say the government got paid? I mean, the KBR got paid.
That argument was never made in the district court. The district court didn't make a finding that KBR was paid. In fact, the district court spent several pages dealing with the findings of fact and conclusions on the pay when paid and prevention doctrine, and that's pages 2398 to 2401 of the joint appendix. If the district court had found as a factual matter that KBR had been paid, then it wouldn't have needed to go on for several pages and address the legal issues and the prevention doctrine. So it wasn't raised in the district court. There is no fact-finding by the district court on that issue. So I believe that argument has been waived because it's raised for the first time on appeal.
I'm just going to keep you 1 minute more if you could just address why is the district court wrong on this prevention doctrine?
On the prevention doctrine, it's because of the wrongfulness requirement, Your Honor.
And why wasn't it wrongful to negotiate and settle a claim that gave away TES's rights without informing TES that it had those rights, such as a claim over against the government?
It didn't breach the contract. It doesn't violate any provision of the contract for KBR to enter into the settlement with the government.
A certain amount of good faith that if you're going to negotiate a subcontractor's rights away, that you do so after telling them, and not do so with. In other words, they deliberately chose not to tell TES about the implications of his negotiations, and they negotiated away its rights.
Your Honor, under Texas law, there is no implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in contracts. We have, in our brief, they cite the Urban Masonry case, which applied the prevention doctrine based on an implied duty of good faith, and we say that they don't cite any cases in Texas, and I can give the court a cite.
Texas rejected it?
Yes, Texas has considered and rejected it. 1983, in English versus Fisher, the Texas Supreme Court addressed the duty generally whether there's an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in contracts. The Supreme Court said no. That's the seminal case on it. In 1995, one of our courts of appeals in the Electro Associates versus Harrop construction case, and this is not in our brief, it's 908 Southwest 2nd at page 21, specifically looked at this in the relationship of a contractor and subcontractor, said it's never been addressed in Texas, and the court there declined to imply a duty of good faith and fair dealing in that context. The Supreme Court, our Texas Supreme Court in 1996 in the Formosa decision, which is cited in the brief, cited that case with approval, reaffirmed English versus Fisher that there's no duty of good faith and fair dealing in Texas. So it has to either come from a violation of a contractual duty or some other duty imposed by law, and in Texas we don't have an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. So it wasn't wrongful because it didn't violate the contract. There's no finding by the district court that it violated the contract. There's no allegation by TES that it violated the contract.
Well, in Amendment 2, you have the provision that says the government has a recent decision concerning the amount of the government holdback that it will refund to KBR, including the amount of the KBR holdback that KBR will refund TES. Now, the latter part simply is incorrect. And if you accept the district court's findings that they were misrepresentations or fraud, why isn't that the act of wrongdoing that prevents the pay when paid clause from applying?
Because that isn't the preventative conduct it issued. The preventative conduct looks at what KBR did relative to the government in the settlement. What TES wants to do is to argue the preventative conduct now is how KBR handled the settlement with it. So you have the KBR government settlement, then you have the KBR TES settlement, and the preventative conduct that would be relevant to the pay when paid clause deals with the KBR government contract, not the KBR TES contract. Because at that point, by the time KBR was negotiating with TES, the deal with the government was done. And whether that conduct was wrongful or is not wrongful was the issue. The district court did not find it was wrongful.
Well, the district court found that KBR released the government from all claims relating to the DFAC invoices, including the TES invoices, and it never told TES that it was doing so.
Yes.
And then it tries to invoke a pay when paid clause after eliminating by agreement that clause as to $55 million. And why isn't that wrong? There's nothing in TES's contract that permits KRB to release the claims that TES had.
There is nothing in the KBR-TES agreement that prevents KBR from settling with the government. It did not violate
any... settling. I'm talking about releasing TES's claims.
That's
what the court found.
Yes, Your Honor. The answer is it doesn't violate the contract. There is no finding by the district court that it's a breach of contract. No one has cited any provision of the contract that breaches.
The contract was Kellogg agreed to pay TES when paid.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then Kellogg goes to the government and releases not only that, but releases all claims that TES might have over against the government when it isn't paid. It did have that right, didn't it? If it's not paid, the TES gets a right to sue the government directly, and that was released.
TES has the right to sue the government under Section 3.0 if there's a government decision. This was done as a settlement, and so that provision isn't triggered. KBR did release all claims that it had against the government, but again, that wasn't a breach of contract. There was no finding by the district court, and there hasn't been an allegation by TES.
I just read the finding that I thought would cover that, his finding in paragraph 37.
I don't believe that is a finding that would be a breach of contract, Your Honor.
All right. You have some rebuttal time, and why don't we hear from Mr. Crawford?
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Crawford. I represent TES, the appellee and plaintiff in the trial below. I'm here with my co-counsel, Monica Monday. The trial court found that KBR carried out a corporate scheme devised to conceal and mislead TES and induce TES to release KBR from over $12 million that was owed. This is evidenced. The court found this. The record fully supports it. KBR doesn't come in here arguing to the contrary. The trial judge found this based in part upon a KBR settlement strategy memorandum that was distributed by email on March 29, 2005, and that's at page 2596 through 2600 of the record, in which KBR laid out its intention to provide misleading and inaccurate information to its subcontractors and also acknowledged that it was at risk to its subcontractors for overpayment or over-recovery, as they called it, because they had released or were going to release the government. Now, this is significant, not just
contractors, not just TES.
Correct. I think they use the term vendors. But
how many were there on the company?
There were, I don't know exactly. There were 55 to 60 dining facility sites, and most vendors operated more than one site. TES was the largest vendor, and KBR's obligation was larger to TES than to anyone
else.
It was the largest vendor, that's correct.
What percentage did it have?
It had, out of $55 million holdback, KBR told TES that it was responsible for $12.5 million. So offhand, that's in the range of over 20%, I believe 23%. So out of all the sites, the number of sites and the volume of work done by TES accounted for approximately 23% of the dining facility activity at the time under this task order. The memorandum that I referenced is important not just to the undisputed and conclusively established fraud and intent to mislead, but it's also key to what the court was discussing just a few moments ago with appellant, because that memorandum was circulated by email on March 29th of 2005. KBR signed its settlement agreement with the government on March 31st, 2005. When KBR signed the government agreement, it already knew and had its plan in place to misrepresent the nature of that agreement to its to TES. And to its other subcontractors. All of this is part and parcel of a corporate course of action that was specifically intended to deceive, conceal, and enrich KBR at the expense of TES. So,
if we give you all that, how'd you prove the $12 million damage?
It was never in dispute. KBR agreed.
They say in their papers it's in dispute.
Well, they say in their papers that in the briefing.
There's a dispute in this appeal, for sure.
It was a finding of fact by the court. It's supported by the record. KBR acknowledged that TES's invoices totaled $36 million in change, and they stipulated an amendment to the exact amount of the invoices.
Right.
They stipulated an amendment.
Those
were
the amount of the invoices.
Correct.
But there was not an agreement as to how the invoices were calculated. But there was
Your Honor.
That was part of the whole thing, is how you came up with the numbers you put on them, wasn't it?
No, there's two different things that the court is talking about. The amount of the invoices is TES's invoices submitted to KBR for the performance of its work at these dining facilities in Iraq.
That was actually a negotiated number, wasn't it, the $36 million? It was received a week pursuant to a stipulation between the parties as to...
I don't believe that number was negotiated. That was based on TES's actual invoices and the methodology, to answer the court's question. The methodology was stipulated to by the parties in Agreement 1, which had been executed sometime prior. And KBR at trial acknowledged that TES had done the work, had properly invoiced the work, that the amount of its invoices was $36 million plus the, I don't know the exact figure
offhand.
You
basically say that the damages were never in dispute.
They were never in dispute.
The damages were never in dispute. It was $12.4 million. The only question was whether there was the justifiable reliance. The fraud charge was proven.
Correct. They didn't even brief it in their
the
proposal.
Damages are not even, you're saying damages are not an issue here.
I don't believe the KBR made any mention of the amount of damages in their proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law submitted
to
the court.
They do dispute whether or not you should bear the $12 million. In other words, $36 million they don't challenge, but they do challenge the $12 million reduction. They say the $12 million reduction was appropriate under the pay when paid clause, and that you don't get the $12.4 million or $12.5 million.
That's correct, Your Honor. They do dispute it, but the court,
the amount is not disputed.
That's right.
It's whether you get that $12.5 million.
They disputed the entitlement, but not the amount.
Is your argument basically that KBR is stopped from denying $12.4 million as an amount, not taking into consideration whether there's contractual barrier or payment, but that amount is damages that they're stopped from denying it, trying to get a grip on exactly why you say what your best evidence is in the record that you proved the $12 million?
Because as a matter of fact, that's what they agreed to in Amendment 2. That's the number that was discussed throughout the trial. KBR testified affirmatively that this was the amount that TES had invoiced that was withheld and under consideration. And Bill Walter, at page 1561 of the appendix, he's a vice president of KBR. He testified that the amounts were properly billed, fair and reasonable, calculated in accordance with the right billing methods.
Kellogg has acknowledged this, is that Amendment 2 reduced $36 million to $24 million, knocked off $12.5 million. Amendment 2 did that.
Well, that's right, yes.
And your argument is that reduction of the legitimate invoices was fraudulently induced and therefore should not have occurred. And so the damages are defined by Amendment 2.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And they're set forth on page 2 of Amendment 2, paragraph 4. $12,400,000.
Right, that's
laid out there.
That's correct, and on the
and
first,
that's all you had to prove. That settles.
Well, it's not. It's a fact.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. I'm just trying to.
Right.
You know more about this case than I do. You understand it better than I do, and I'm just trying to figure out where you got the $12.4 million in damages. I mean, the judge spends a whole lot of time on this fraud claim, it comes up at the end and says, and as a result, there's $12.4 million in damages, and there's $4 million in punitive damages. And I was just trying to, and they say you didn't prove the damages. And I'm just trying to give you a chance to give your best shot as to how you proved the damages. And
understood, Your Honor.
And that's what you've tried to do, I think.
The $12.424 million damages comes about like this. TES does its work at its dining facility sites. It submits its invoices to KBR. Amendment 2 recites the party's factual agreement that's consistent with the rest of the record that there's, I believe it's $54 million, there's a $54 million figure that appears on the first page. That's Kuwaiti dinar, and that is converted into U.S. dollars. That amount is $36 million. That amount was the invoices as to which KBR said were fair and reasonable.
No, the district court found a fact.
And he found all that on page 20, paragraph 45. $36 million unpaid amount had previously agreed, everybody agreed, was properly billed to KBR.
Right. That was a finding of fact, and it's supported by the record. Now the $12 million comes from taking the amount that KBR told TES it was instructed and ordered to pay by the government.
Which is specified, it's called the KBR holdback, is that right?
That's right.
That's defined as KBR holdback in Amendment 2.
That's correct.
So all the judge did was assess the damages as the amount of the KBR holdback plus interest, right? Pre-judgment interest.
Correct. It was the difference between
right, the KBR holdback is the damage number.
That's right.
Okay. And then he said plus $4 million in punitive damages.
Yes, Your Honor.
How did he calculate that out? Did he explain where he came up with $4 million as punitives?
Well, that appears in paragraphs 88 and 89 of his
right.
opinion. And he talks about the factors that are...
It says, based on all the evidence and all the relevant considerations, the court finds that the award of punitive damages in the amount of $4 million is appropriate.
Right. And that and he talked about the standards and the extent to which KBR's conduct is by its nature offensive, the nature of what they were doing in administering this contract, the value of the contracts and the financial material that was in evidence at the case, the size of KBR, the amount of compensatory damages that were awarded, and based
he
upon
rely there on page 20, he says on paragraph 88. In paragraph 88,
yes, he goes through step by step,
and all that was done, you say, pursuant to Texas law.
Yes, sir.
That covers all the factors that are required for punitive damages under Texas law. Is that right? There are no deficiencies in there.
That's right, Your Honor. There's no deficiencies, and the court has, it's not a mathematical calculation. The court has discretion based on the trial court has discretion based on the trial judge's application of those factors to determine an appropriate amount. And this was reasonable. It was proportionate in terms of the compensatory damages. It's not an amount that overwhelms the compensatory damages. Frankly, it could have been larger given the conduct, given the overwhelming nature of fraud that KBR doesn't even challenge in this appeal in terms of its false statements knowingly made with the intent of inducing TES's reliance on those statements to walk away from its $12 million. So we believe that it's a textbook case for punitive damages, that the factors were properly considered and applied. The Texas cases talk about clear and convincing evidence that you sustain damages as a result of
fraud.
Standard?
Clear and convincing?
Yes, sir.
They seem to challenge that in their brief.
Well, they challenge that, but that's, again, based upon KBR's view of the weight of the evidence, which they ask this court to reconsider. As we heard before, KBR wants to pick and choose what facts and what findings it even brings to the court's attention in terms of making its own arguments. So they challenge it, but they challenge it without even disputing that they lied, that they lied on purpose, they identify no error in the court's application of the law or consideration of the factors under the facts of this case. So
KBR says that even if we assume there was justifiable reliance and the $12 million figure is correct, that the contract provision, pay when paid clause, doesn't apply, and therefore you're not entitled to any compensatory damages, which you also earn at your punitives. Why don't you talk to us about that?
Well, that provision doesn't help KBR for a number of reasons. First, Texas law, and this is a Texas law that's cited in KBR's briefs as well as our own, Texas law provides that pay if paid is a condition precedent is to be construed narrowly, that forfeitures are disfavored, and if there's any way to read the contract, to give meaning to the contract without without resulting in a forfeiture, then the court is to look for a way to do that. Here we have contract documents consisting of a master agreement, general conditions, supplemental general conditions, and when you read 3.0, it makes very clear that pay one paid has no application in this case because there's nothing about the process in which these payments were received that would bind TES to these figures and allow KBR to rely upon the pay one paid provision. Even if there were, KBR prevented, they didn't just prevent, KBR made occurrence of the condition precedent impossible. They released the government. They didn't just breach the TES contract. They changed the contract. They changed they fundamentally altered the nature of the payment process. And as Judge Trenga found below, the pay-one-paid provisions are inextricably bound to TES's rights to pursue claims for its payments. KBR made it impossible for TES to pursue claims for these payments, and so they're prevented from relying on pay-one-paid. It doesn't work for them.
We find the contract means what it says. The condition preceded, and we're required, in order for you to prevail, we have to then find that there was an act of prevention, legal act of prevention by KBR.
Yes, sir. Your question is, what would the act of prevention be?
Well, now you've just told us the act of prevention.
Right.
Back over again, if you want to. That's, I wanted to be clear on that because it looks like to me that they've got a pretty strong argument that when it says condition preceded is what the Texas cases say is clearly evident or unmistakable agreement.
Right, and the contract does use the word condition, and I acknowledge that. Yes, but the contract documents have to be read together. There's an order of precedence provision in the contract. I think it's cited in our proposed findings below that puts the 3.0 supplemental conditions over the general conditions that contain the pay when paid. But even if you accept all that, Your Honors, they clearly prevented occurrence of the condition. There's nothing. Texas cases occasionally talk about wrongful conduct in connection with the pay when paid and prevention. But wrongful is not. There's nothing to suggest that wrongful is criminal or wrongful is illegal contact. It's just wrongful as to the party against whom the provision is attempting to be asserted within the context of the facts and circumstances of that case. And the conduct was wrongful here, whether you just look at the government settlement in which KBR made an undisclosed and unauthorized waiver of TES's very right to seek payment for its own work. If you even look at that in isolation, that's wrongful as to TES clearly. And if you take a broader view, as Judge Trenga did, and as he made explicit findings of fact that are supported by the record, KBR carried out a continuous course of wrongful conduct. And as I said near the outset of my argument, this plan was in place before they even settled with the government. They went into the government settlement knowing that what they were going to do with that settlement once they received it vis-a-vis TES, and they had a plan in place as to how to better their own bottom line at TES's expense, and that's exactly what they did. That is the evidence is overwhelming that what they did is wrongful, and most of it is not even at issue on this appeal. It's conclusively established.
Do you all agree that Texas tort law applies here?
Yes, sir.
Pardon?
Yes.
The parties agree to that.
Yeah, there's a stipulation at the very outset on the first day of trial when before the first witness is called in some preliminary matters, and there's a stipulation on the record as to the application of Texas law.
Was there any issue raised about the application of American tort law on the battlefield in Iraq?
No, sir, and I don't believe that has any bearing on the issues presented in this case. You've got two private contractors, you've got Texas law, you've got stipulated application of Texas law, and logistical services being provided by a subcontractor to a prime contractor. I don't
contractor for the United States.
To the United States, that's right. That's right. But once the settlement was carried out between KBR and the government, the United States had no dog in the fight. They were completely out of the picture.
It's here in the tort law. Fraud claim.
Well, that's correct. That's correct. So I don't know that I need to address the reliance issues. I will very briefly, in response to some of the things the counsel said in his argument.
You've gone through a red light.
I'm sorry?
Be quick. You've gone through a red light.
Okay. Red light means your time is up.
Right. I understand. It's counting up instead of down. I see that now.
Take a minute.
My apologies. Thank you, Your Honor. All of the issues that were discussed on the reliance, and particularly the justifiable reliance, because there's no disputing the factual finding that there was actual reliance here. All of the emphasis is on justifiable reliance, was on factual issues. Talk about red flags. Talk about the significance of a single piece of evidence, a newspaper article or media report, in the context of everything else that was going on. When KBR put their senior and highest-ranking person in the Middle East, a retired three-star general, in a room with TES to deliver a false message, and two of the three people for KBR didn't even know that the message was false. These are factual issues. The judge made explicit findings on it in paragraph 52. The Grant Thornton case that KBR relies on so heavily talks specifically about justifiable reliance from the perspective of the particular characteristics of the plaintiff within the facts and circumstances of the case. That's not an issue of law. That's an issue of fact. And the court made explicit findings of fact that are fully supported by the evidence on the reliance. Everyone for TES testified that they the record is very clear that they addressed their concerns about what they had previously heard and read with KBR. They received assurances about it. They received written assurances about it from someone that was put there specifically to be trusted. Mr. Surgeon's words were, KBR management sent him to these meetings so that the message could be delivered from as high a level as possible to give it credibility. And that's at 4004 of the record. And it worked. These are facts. This is a factual dynamic, and it's not an issue of law. There was one reference. There was actually a reference to red flags in the trial testimony by by TES's representative Greg Bishop, when he said, "We gave them the draft agreement. If it had come back with any significant changes, that would have been a red flag. There were no changes. I never had any doubts about the sincerity of KBR's representations, and we went forward." This is before any talk about case law or standards or red flags as a matter of law. They looked for red flags. They saw none there. And the justifiable reliance is fully supported. The court's findings on that are set forth explicitly in paragraph 52 and fully supported by the evidence in the record. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Harris, some rebuttal.
May it please the court, I'll address one issue on reliance and I'll turn to the damages issues. The district court here applied the wrong legal standard. That is reviewed de novo by this court. Our argument addresses the consequences of that ruling, as Judge Niemeyer pointed out. That's what our position is. It's based on the undisputed evidence, the press release that was never challenged, the Wall Street Journal article that's never challenged, that told TES the true state of affairs, and that was ignored. That is improper as a matter of law to allow justifiable reliance under Texas law. TES agrees that the pay when paid clause is a condition precedent. They dispute that wrongfulness was required under Texas law, but that is very clear that it is. One of the cases cited...
I didn't hear him say that. I thought he said it was wrongful. He says it's wrongful. Can you measure wrongfulness vis-a-vis his client?
I thought I heard him say both, but let me address both of those. On whether wrongfulness is required, one of the cases in our brief is the Tacon Mechanical case. There, what is basically the prevention doctrine was referred to as the wrongful interference with contract performance, and the court stated the rule that when one party to a contract, by wrongful means, prevents the other party from performing, this interference with performance constitutes a breach of contract. And that's consistent with the restatement. TES argues that it's just some sort of a nebulous wrongful ask to the other party. That's not right. It requires a breach. The restatement is very clear. Section 245 talks about the preventive conduct must be a breach, and that's in the heading of the section as well as the text, where a party's breach by non-performance contributes materially, et cetera, et cetera. So it's clear the restatement is looking either to a breach of that agreement, and the restatement also looks to some other duty implied by law. In Texas, there is no other implied duty, so it has to be a breach of the agreement. Your Honor, you had asked about paragraph 37 and why that isn't a finding of breach. The sentence that, in addition, KBR released the government from all claims relating to the DFAC invoices, that's KBR's claims. There was no privity of contract between TES and the government. The release from KBR was releasing all of its claims to the government. There was no privity with TES and the government.
I thought TES had a right over against the government in certain circumstances.
Under Section 3.0,
yeah.
If there was a decision as used within that phrase, and KBR gives notice of that to the subcontractor then elects to have KBR assert its right. So basically the subcontractor has to sue the...
Was that right given away by Kellogg?
Section 3.0 was never triggered because there was not a government decision. There was a settlement agreement reached, and because there was an agreement, that triggers a different provision.
But under the release given to the government, did Kellogg purport to get rid of all subcontractor claims against the government?
What it did is it failed to trigger 3.0, and 3.0 is what allows the subcontractor to sue the government through KBR.
But Judge Tringa said in paragraph 37, KBR released the government
right
from all claims relating to the DFAC invoices, including those pertaining to TES invoices.
Yes, but those would be KBR claims. KBR is the only one that has a claim against the government because KBR is the only one that's in privity of contract with the government. For 3.0 to be triggered,
how did the contract between Kellogg and the government address the government's potential liability from subcontractors? Was there any indemnity? Was there protection? An effort to release them?
I don't believe it.
What kind of protection did Kellogg give the government?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. There may have been some indemnity provision, as you would find in a standard contract. I don't know. I don't think the government needs any because the government can't be sued by the subs because there is no privity of contract. If the sub is unhappy with what happens, it can sue KBR because it's in privity of contract with KBR, or under the contract under Section 3.0, if that is triggered because there's a government decision, then the subcontractor can go to KBR and say, I want you to sue the government on my behalf. But the sub has no way to go around KBR and sue the government directly. There is no direct claim. So I don't know if there's any provision in the contract. There might be a general indemnity provision, but that would be all that I'm aware of. I'm not aware of any express provision because I don't believe one's needed.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll come down and recounsel and take a short recess.
We will take a brief recess.